Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Glad to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. How are we this fine morning?
I feel pretty good. Morning? You know, Thanksgiving's coming, one of my favorite holidays. You know, it's a nice time of year. It's not fall-ish, but it's cloudy.
Yeah, you know.
Cloudy if too warm.
People are freaking out about the rain a little bit.
I just like a change. I mean, it's just so dang hot and sunny here all the time. It's
The 85 in December, in November last week, or early last week, I guess, over the weekend was not
kind of lame.
Not great. So the big news is we get together today still, it's now a couple days old as we meet on Thursday morning, is the federal court ruling invalidating the congressional maps passed by the legislature. Now, there are other big stories out there, and we'll kind of wind up backing into one or two of them, I think. But in a 2-1 vote, a 3-judge panel ruled that Texas must set aside the new congressional maps that it drew earlier this year, with the majority writing that the map, which would create
designed and intended.
Sort of designed and intended to create up to 5 new GOP-friendly House seats, was an unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. And if you look at the decision, the opinion in this, it was, you know, that's more specific than you might think.
Right.
Right, in terms of it being a racial gerrymandering, being a kind of legal classification and characterization of the maps. The ruling is very pointed. And look, for those of you who, you know, may not routinely read these, but are followers of Texas politics, it's, you know, there's a lot of like, oh, I know that guy, you know, as they're going through and trying to unpack the rationalizations and the public statements for the maps, a lot of, you know, known players in the process that, you know, it's not trying to be coy about this, a lot of discussion of very, you know, specific justifications and some fact checks in some cases about what intent was, who knew what when, who had meetings with whom and under what circumstances, you know, involving, you know, a lot of people and some pretty, you know, pretty close parsing of the governor's statements as to the intent and rationale for nobody disputes.
Yeah, that's true. Right. That's
right?
Fair.
So that's not unfair.
Right.
You know, I would say very worth looking at. If you follow this and again, what? You know, and it's pretty salty and, you know, it was the ruling is written by District Judge Jeffrey Brown and also signed on to by J.H. David Wadarama. Brown is has gotten a lot of attention. Trump appointee, Wadarama is Obama appointee. But, you know, Judge Jeffrey Brown has been around in Texas politics for a while.
I mean, right.
Appointed as a district judge, then later an appellate judge, and then elevated to the state Supreme Court. Initial appointments were by Governor Perry, and then nominated by Donald Trump, you know, presumably with input from Texas,
right?
For the federal court,
right? So you can't just, you know, dismiss the ruling as from some partisan appointee of the other side, all that
right.
Kind of, you know. I mean, it's not that easy to dismiss. I mean, not that people aren't
trying.
Which
is a good setup for the scathing dissent that was issued by Reagan appointee Jerry Smith, who's been on the court for a very long time, obviously. Been a federal judge for a long time, and he was the appellate judge on the panel, I believe.
Yeah.
And you know, the scathing, you know, we'll talk about the scathing language on both sides, I suppose, to be fair. I mean, you know, the choice language to characterize the, you know, the, and it's been widely quoted in coverage. You don't have to read the decision to see this, that was used by Judge Brown to characterize the Justice Department memo that was at least initially used in the, you know, specifically in the first call for a special session, which was the motivation for this, you know, as, you know, basically factually inaccurate, you know, misinterpreting, you know, misinterpreted, you know, the key case that was, it was supposed to be characterizing. And he, you know, also said, you know, typographically lacking. So, ouch. You know, I mean, yeah, ouch. It was, it's pretty rough. I mean, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, thumping that goes on here. And then, you know, for his part, Judge Smith and the dissent, you know, raises, you know, Jerry Brown and Soros and all, you know, so it's, you know, it's a very interesting decision and dissent.
You've read a little bit, read a little bit more than I have, so I don't want to put you on the spot here. But I mean, my impression, at least from the coverage, was that a lot of the dissent's thrust was more so about, you know, the notion of like, this is an activist decision. And so, I mean, is it about like whether the court has the authority to even be sort of?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there was, you know, and I've not read through the whole thing, but I mean, there were a couple of things that were going on. There was some of that. There was, you know, a lot of, I mean, there was a level of it was just that this was too political.
Right.
Right? This was politically motivated.
I want to raise an important set piece to understand that in general, as we understand it, you know, when a quote unquote political question is coming up, of which, you know, yeah, the drawing of maps can be and can edge into this other area of, you know, rights and liberties, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. But in general, you know, we kind of tend to believe that the courts, for the most part, don't want to insert themselves or try not to insert themselves into overtly political questions or fights.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with redistricting, though, it's, you know, well, it's, kind of,
it's kind of impossible here, but, yeah, but that's why I thought the argument was a little interesting to sort of, you know.
Well, I mean, if you look, I mean, I think if you look at the decision, yeah, I mean, if you look at that dissent, I mean, it's even less like the court shouldn't be engaging in, yeah, a political argument. It was just, it was much more personal and direct,
yeah,
in saying that, you know, the judge was basically, quasi-literally says, siding with George Soros and Gavin Newsom and the overall political fight. I mean, it's very direct. So it's
interesting.
You know, yeah, it's pretty interesting. And then also a process piece in which, you know, clearly, and by clearly, I mean explicitly, Judge Smith was angry that he accuses the two other judges of not giving him sufficient time to compose his dissent. And the dissent did come out kind of late, right?
Yeah.
So, or, you know, at a interval after the release of the actual opinion. So there's a lot going on here, right?
We, yeah,
just
it's
said, there's a lot going on here.
Really fascinating.
You know, personally and politically here between, you know, on this panel.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, sort of another, a whole other thing unto itself. But, you know, basic point, if, you know, if you follow the legislature closely and if you've been following this process, it's worth digging into, you know, the kind of middle part of the ruling, because there's just a lot of blow by blow,
mm-hmm,
you know, and then, you know, and I didn't want to be coy earlier. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, detailed discussion of comments and justifications and accounts and some of the testimony given during the hearings by, you know, Chairman Hunter, Chairman King, David Spiller, and then of course, you know, a pretty close parsing of the governor's statements. So, you know, I would look for that. Now, Attorney General Ken Paxton, not surprisingly, quickly announced his intent to file an appeal with the Supreme Court of the United States and to ask for a stay of the order, you know, I think pending it being overturned, you know, pending a full hearing. And right, you and I were talking about this before. I don't want to get out of my lane.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked to some other people that are constitutional scholars, you know, that do research at least adjacent to this and kind of weren't entirely sure what the court's options were given the nature of this panel. If you know this, I mean, I'm, you know, kind of waiting to see, you know, what other people that really live in this stuff say about it. And a lot of my usual sources have not posted yet. By my usual sources, I mean Steve Vladeck.
Right.
Who I'm like, I don't know if you're out, well, Steve probably doesn't listen to this, but if you know Steve Vladeck, tell him, you know, we're kind of waiting on a post from his Substack to
explain,
you know, see what his view of this is, because he's had a pretty good track record on court watching and does a good job of explaining these things. And is also good at saying, you know, yeah, I thought this was going to happen. I was right about this. I was wrong about this,
mm-hmm,
which we could all use more of. So for the moment, I mean, we're in an interesting political moment on this, though, as we wait to see what and when and how the court is going to rule, you know. But for the moment, the maps passed at the Trump administration's direction this summer are out. Right. Previous maps are nominally in effect, with speculation now turning, of course, to what the court's going to do. And so we're seeing a lot of gestures already, certainly among Democrats,
right,
you know, that are a mixture of self-interest and also clearly an effort to sort of present the current situation as the situation. And what I mean by that is, you know, Lloyd Doggett has said he'll
back and running.
I'll get back in, and I believe Greg Kassar has now said he'll go back to running to the other, you know,
right,
the original in his district.
Houston's going to be a whole throw up into a mess.
A lot of
signals
coming out of Houston.
Ninth,
what's going on there? And I'm sure we'll, you know, I'm probably missed things in some of the other races. So the politics are very much, you know, active right now with, you know, the durability of the status quo very much in question. I mean, I was talking to somebody yesterday and said, I was reading these court decisions, and the first thing reasonably watchful and knowledgeable person said was, well, you know, Supreme Court's just going to overturn it, right?
Well, I mean, not exactly, but yeah, I mean, I think that's the real question right now. I mean, what I said to someone else is, like, there are sort of two dates that we're kind of watching for, one that we know about and one that we don't.
Yeah.
Right. The one that we know about is the candidate filing deadline. And for the most part, you know, if you're one of those Democrats, like, it really, I mean, it behooves all the Democrats who want to try to create the current 2021 map as the status quo to file under those districts, to put their names in there,
right,
and to do all the legal requirements necessary to say these are the districts we're running in.
Yeah.
Because ultimately that does, I mean, I'm going to say the Supreme Court's going to do whatever the Supreme Court wants to do, but it does put some pressure on the backside to say, you know, ultimately the filing deadline is a little bit of a, I don't want to say it's a drop dead date because you know things can be moved, things can be adjusted, but in general the courts aren't going to want to interfere once like candidates have filed and they're running and
messy. I mean, the other issue floating around here that I do want to talk to some con law people about is the degree to which the Attorney General's request, Attorney General Paxton's request for a stay, becomes kind of a shadow docket matter because of the urgency of all those issues and the timing of that.
And that's the other date that we don't know.
Exactly.
So we know that. And the other date is how long it takes the court to respond. I think Quorum Report was quick to point out that they've responded as quickly as 11 days to these kinds of matters in the past for Texas.
I think Scott Braddock had a post on that pretty quickly.
And
and then the other thing, this goes back to something that we raised as kind of a, you know, whatever, just a thing to keep in mind over the last few months, over, you know, after the passage of these maps, is that depending on what this all looks like, you know, if the Supreme Court does anything other than a very clear thumbs up or thumbs down, say they remand it back
to whatever,
to the federal court. Yeah. And remember, this hearing came out of the federal court hearing on the 2021 maps.
Right.
This has been spun out of that, as I recall. And so if it's remanded back to that court, then we're back into considering the possibility of the 2012 scenario where maybe the primary date moves.
Yeah, which is totally possible. I mean,
which is kind of the upshot of what you were, I think, kind of getting at earlier in terms of the deadlines and dates.
No, that's right. And I think, you know, I mean, it's one of those really interesting areas where, you know, in addition to sort of the arcane, you know, realities of law and procedure and all that kind of stuff that we're less expert in, you know, one of the things that I think we're more expert in, but that we're unfortunately forced to be honest about, is like, we really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, just to put it out there. And that's the key here is, you know, the deadline's important because then, you know, we have a constellation of candidates who think they're running in a district.
Right.
We have voters who technically they could already be communicating with, and that, you know, creates pressure. But at the same time, there's nothing that stops the Supreme Court and, you know, honestly, all these courts from moving these elections
to
accommodate
this. And it doesn't
have
to be the Supreme. I mean, a federal court can do it as a consequence of
And so,
what's floating around out there.
Yeah, and I think there's another piece of this too, which is, you know, before the Democrats get too, you know, on their high horse about this, I mean, ultimately, what they're arguing about is two maps that they're both contesting. They're contesting both of those sets of maps. So it's not like they can say no, they have to be the 2021 maps and not the 2025 maps because they're less racist.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a tough one, you know?
Well, you know, look, we're not here to talk about the decision, and I don't know how much of it you've read, but I mean, one of the fascinating things about the decision is the way that it, I'm going to use this word anyway because interpret isn't quite strong enough, is the way that it really interpolates this new conception of what's allowable in the use of race and what's not.
Yeah.
And there's a technical issue of whether Pettaway, the course, the decision in Pettaway, what it actually, how far it actually limited the use of coalition districts. And the judge hinges a lot on that, because one of the hinges of this decision is he said the Justice Department memo misunderstood and mischaracterized Pettaway. And then that mistake was replicated in the way that all the Texas political leaders rationalized and executed the maps.
Right.
And that was actually about, and so what we're in there saying, yeah, the Republicans should not have drawn these maps because they were too racially conscious in their effort to use this flawed interpretation of Pettaway as banning coalition districts or having anything to do with it. I mean, I'm, you know, legal experts, lawyers out there, I know that I'm fuzzing that up a little bit, but I think that's basically correct.
Yeah.
And so, you know, really the big thing is like you guys used an inappropriately used a racial rationale.
Yeah.
And that's pretty wild in a certain, you know,
yeah.
if you step back, I mean, it makes sense. And you, when you're in the logic of it, but in the historical arc of these things, it's like, oh,
well, no, I mean, I don't think you need to be a legal expert here just to sort of step back and look at sort of the politics of it. And if you've watched enough sort of redistricting exercises over the years, know that one, I mean, sort of there's two things. One, every other redistricting effort we've seen is notable for how little is said, right? Especially by the people creating the maps in terms of how they're thinking. I mean, the sort of the watchword, as I recall from every other redistricting hearing we ever have ever seen, is race and ethnicity was not considered in the right. construction of these maps. And that is repeated over and over and over again. And they learned after, you know, the 2000, you know, redistricting fiasco about what they're going to communicate in emails and what they're going to say publicly. Yeah. And the, what's sort of been so notable about these processes is just, again, how careful they are, knowing that regardless of what happens, they're putting down a record that's going to go into a lawsuit.
Yeah.
And this was both marked by, one, a total jettisoning of that, you know, sort of general care, to your point about how, you know, you can go blow by blow through the statements that people were making. But then also the other part of it was sort of, I think what you're pointing out, which is, again, without a legal, it's sort of getting a little bit over the skis here. Like, this decision was made, what its implications are, how far it goes, and what it fully means is still going to be litigated. And that's part of the open question here. But to assume that, like, even if it's, you know, misinterpreted or whatever, that essentially, you know, we have a new world, we can do this a different way, we can be open about how we're doing it, it's fine, was a pretty big leap of faith.
You know, yeah,
I think even,
I mean,
even while it was happening.
Well, what the judge thinks is that it wasn't faith.
Yeah, well, that's
it right. was just a mistake, right? It was just wrong.
Yeah.
And, the, and, you know, and look, I mean, I think this was noticeable during the discussion, and we'll move on. But,
yeah.
you know, as we saw the rationale for the maps move on, and then it was pointed out that that DOJ memo may have been mistaken. That was happening mm-hmm. in real time.
Yeah.
And you did see a real, you saw a shift from, we're doing this, and the cover is DOJ has told us that the coalition districts are mm-hmm. inadmissible use of race, can't do it.
Right.
To once they realized that that was shaky, you did get this more blanket, which I think really fits what you're saying. This kind of blanket assumption that as long as we just say
right.
that now we're doing it for partisan reasons, and that's totally allowable, that we're going to be fine.
Right. Even though we're dismantling districts based on race, because
right.
that's what the rationale,
you know,
we're
based
using.
On, and they and then they sort of acted, again, there was an active effort to not, you know, later on,
yeah.
after the Democrats left and came back, I mean, the tone of the debates and even the tone of the language, which we noted at the time, I mm-hmm. think even on the podcast, even the rationale that was used in the language of the second special session call compared to the first mm-hmm. special session call, Governor Abbott omitted reference to the to the DOJ memo in the second call, and that was widely noticed at the time.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, and Abbott, you know, Abbott distanced himself from that DOJ letter almost as quickly as he sort of swept
right.
it up.
But,
I mean,
but you know, but this is why, like, reading the decision is really pretty great
yeah.
or, you know, super interesting, because the judge addresses that
yeah.
very directly. And kind of turns that, you know, kind of uses that as evidence that in the first instance, mm-hmm. this was instigated by that. They may have,
yeah.
you know, shifted gears later, but the, you know, his argument, and this is one of the things, you know, one could argue this different ways.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think will be reviewed is whether his argument that, you know, they started the process based on this and whatever they said later. If we're looking at what the rationale was mm-hmm. and what triggered this process, it was this flawed understanding and this inadmissible deployment of race.
Yeah.
So we shall see. Now, the political kind of piece of this, you know, that has really been a part of the political reading of this in the kind of inside politics world mm-hmm. of, you know, the Politico and all this kind of, you know, Politico world, shall we call it, is that this does throw kind of a wrench into the overall redistricting plan. And, you know, people, you know, it's hard to miss the irony that Texas aggressiveness on this really triggered this. The California thing is now passed, and now the Texas thing has been undone.
Right.
Potentially.
Potentially.
Right. But at least for the moment.
For the moment.
It's been undone or at least called into question. And, you know, in that sense, if you're just looking at the horse race aspect of this, it's potentially an unfortunate setback for what, you know, you were speculating this from the beginning, may have been a very strong, you know, considerable overestimation of what Republicans could get out of this and gaining House seats to begin with.
Yeah.
But even worse now, and the whole thing is kind of metastasized in some ways, but the original sort of instigation is now being called into question. So there is the question of, like, what is the implication, you know, that this is not even what. We know that this is going to have implications for one way or whatever way for the effort of Republicans to hang on to the House and what the playing field of the 2026 midterms look like in terms of Congress.
It does make you wonder. I mean, I'm just wondering right now. I'll just throw this out there, actually. I was sort of thinking to myself, you know, about criticisms of the court recently in the shadow docket. And I think there's a lot of expectations on the left in particular that, you know, the court is going to basically, you know, rubber stamp the status quo of the 2025 map and kind of just sort of say,
The person who said to me, you know, oh yeah, they're just going to overturn it was somebody to the left of center.
That describes the person.
Yes, yes.
Right. And now I think if anything, if you've been watching politics over the last, you know, year and a half, you'd say, yeah, that seems like a pretty...
Odds on bet.
The question, I guess, would be, you know, given the broader environment that we're talking about here, you know, polling data that is increasingly unfavorable to the president, you know, both in general, but I mean, in particular, when we're talking about Texas and these congressional districts, among key groups that they would expect and need to be effective with in terms of, you know, just... I want to say the way they draw these districts to guarantee a victory, but certainly to guarantee a comfortable victory in those districts, right? And so you sort of wonder at this point, you have the Supreme Court hands down, you know, decision that kind of puts these maps in where, you know, a Trump-appointed judge has this decision out basically just blasting the crap out of these maps for all these reasons. You know, does that really
No, well, it's help? Funny you would say that because, you know, well, on the other side of that, Rick Hasen did a quick post after the dissent came out. And saying that the nature of the dissent, because it was so personal,
that's what
and
I was
so
going to say to you. It's problematic.
May have hurt the chances that the Supreme Court, the majority on the Supreme Court's impulse to just
I was going to say that
to restore
you
the maps
when you
was
were,
probably hurt.
I was going to say that to you because I mean, and that's and I want to be fair because that's where the timing thing actually matters. Yeah. Like if he had more time to write the dissent, maybe it would be a more let's just say, legally based and less personal dissent.
He says that explicitly at the beginning. He's like, hey, look, this is a little scattershot.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't say, you know, because these assholes didn't, you know, give me enough time. It's sorry. It's a little disorganized.
But
it's very explicit.
But that's the thing, though. But for those, again, you know, the dissent is where, you know, in some ways the arguments against the ruling are supposed to be drawn from.
Right.
And so the fact that he didn't have time or didn't get in there, wherever those arguments are. It is a problem, potentially. But again...
Well, and what it does is it gives, you know, it could potentially give the Supreme Court, a way of slowing this all down or, you know, rolling it back to some point, some unknown point that is a little more procedural than substantive.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one other thing that, you know, it's like, oh, look, you know, we... You know, while we don't approve of his tone, we take, you know, the judge's, you know, complaints and think it did flaw the process and ergo.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
to remand it in some way.
Again, if you've been watching redistricting fights, court cases around voting laws, all that kind of stuff for some number of years, the number of times the decision ultimately is like that. It just turns it back to some procedural point in time based on some, you know, potential flaw in some part of the process. Everybody who's waiting for something goes, oh, wait, what does that mean? You know?
Yeah, no, look, courts have, you know, I mean, going back to some degree to your political decision argument, which I'm not sure fits exactly just what he was doing, but more broadly, you know, the courts, judges, but Supreme Court, they find interesting and creative ways to avoid things that they're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they've in some ways, you know, the courts have more ability to do that than most actors in the political process.
Right. So the, you know, I mean, so all of this, and particularly the piece about how this, you know, one more wrinkle in thinking about the elections next year, which you've been talking a bit the last few podcasts, you know, it does fold into this bigger topic of what's going on nationally in terms of the state of the balance of power between the parties, what the terrain of the election is going to look like, and Donald Trump's position and his political capital in this moment, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think there have been a lot of things in the last couple weeks. Some of this has been conversations I've had with people, but it, you know, it's also been edging in. I was going to go to my inbox and take a screenshot. I mean, you know, the last week, I could just go to the subject line in my Gmail and see a lot of, you know, is MAGA cracking up?
Right.
You know, is, you know, tension in the coalition, you know, has Trump lost the support of MAGA? A lot of that is just driven by the Epstein case.
Right. Fishers.
But, you know, but we had talked about wanting to kind of unpack this and kind of assess this. I mean, you know, so, I mean, we can start in any number of places and we've gathered some data.
I don't even know if we need that much of this data, really.
I don't think so, actually. But it's kind of useful to have some of it. But I mean, we can just keep going on this. And time-wise, we probably spent more time on the first part than we would have anyway. But I mean, I think there is. Yeah, I mean, look. I mean, what we prepared and, you know, the kind of usual stuff we do.
Yeah.
You know.
Let me make a broad.
Where's the partisan structure on redistricting as a topic as this works its way through the system? And, you know, the main thing, one thing we do know is that, you know, not a ton of people compared to other issues reported having heard a lot about this. I mean, nobody, but.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of in the middle of the pack. It's not a high salience issue. But I mean, I think one of the things
we're probably talking, you know, in other words, we went back and looked at the news battery responses from our last poll in October where we give people, you know, we've talked about this on here. We use this data. We give people a list of things that have been in the news and, you know,
political stories,
seemingly, you know, people following politics have paying attention to, and just ask people how much they've heard about it.
Yeah, and then you find out that normal people have heard a lot less than you have.
Right.
But, I mean, basically, the gist is it's not, you know, a super high salience issue. And I think part of it reflects the fact that, you know, in Texas, nobody was asking for this. I mean, this wasn't something that was, like, on the radar of the public. This was something that was thrust, you know, sort of into the process very directly and very noisily. And so what you find is, not surprisingly, you know, more attention to this among Democrats, obviously, than among, you know, independents and Republicans. Overall, you know, we saw plurality opposition to efforts to redraw the district lines back in August when we asked about it. 41% were opposed, 34% approved. Not surprisingly, 25%, no idea, because this has just sort of kind of came out of nowhere. And also, redistricting is generally a little bit esoteric for normal people, you know, who don't follow this stuff. Overall, you know, we look at the partisan distribution, you know, it's one of those intensity things again. You know, 78% of Democrats disapproved of efforts to redraw the line, 72% strongly disapproved. 65% of Republicans approved, so almost two-thirds, but only 45% would say they approved strongly. So again, less of an intense issue because it wasn't something, again, that people were talking about asking for. This is a very strategic political effort.
And gain, you know, and look, the Democrats got one thing they wanted.
Yeah.
At least from the quorum break, which is it did raise the salience of it.
Well, and I'll say
put it in a national context.
They got two things. You know why? Because honestly, we're close to the filing deadline. And they pushed this court case closer to the filing deadline, which does create extra pressure on the process. So, I mean, they did get two things out of it. And then I'll say, you know, one other piece of this is, you know, Donald Trump's efforts to redraw Texas's congressional districts. 48% of Texans disapproved of that, 35% approved. This was in August. 91% of Democrats disapproved, 57% of independents. But, and this will kind of probably take us into the B block a little bit of this.
Yeah, right.
But 70% of Republicans approved of this effort, 48% strongly, so not a majority. But it's not as though this is against public opinion within the base of the
party. Right, that's exactly right. I mean, that's why we had this. You know, that's a good thing to set up. So
okay.
So, you know, over the last couple of weeks, like I've said, you know, we've talked about this question of, you know, and it, you know, it's obviously an important question because Trump has been such a galvanizing force among Republicans in any number of ways, public opinion, elite opinion, institutional behavior. We've talked about this, all those things a lot. and over the last couple of weeks in the podcast, and we've looked at, you know, this question of the slight erosion of Trump's position in Texas, and probably more than slight nationally, I think, which we should expect.
Yeah, I think that's right, based on partisan distribution.
Yeah, and, you know, you and I were talking, you know, there was, you know, some very recent national polling.
Mm-hmm.
I think both NPR, Marist, and Fox released new national polling yesterday,
mm-hmm.
all of which showed Donald Trump's job approval continuing to be pretty unimpressive, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think moving in really a pretty negative trend. I mean, if you kind of divide the data up, you know, we're looking at sort of the Real Clear Politics averages and also just looking at the polls that have come out. And even if you look at the polls sort of from earlier in November versus later in November,
yeah,
you know, you can see that, you know, earlier in November, for the most part, we're talking about the spread here. So the share who approve minus the share who disapprove. And in general, his net approval rating has been, you know, range between, you know, around, I would say, mid negative teens, negative 13, negative 17, negative 14. When we look at sort of the more recent Fox News poll, negative 17. So the average that we see over the month is about minus 12 on the spread. But actually, the more recent polling, it looks a little bit, I mean, all the recent polls are higher than that, just to say it out loud. That's a good way to kind of think about the trend of it. And that's, you know, similar to what we've seen in Texas to some degree, right? I mean, when he started out, you know, his overall job approval in Texas at the beginning of the year was 52 approve,
right.
38 disapprove. Today it's 51 disapprove, 42 approve. So his approval has gone down 10 points. His disapproval has gone up 13 points. Again, among Republicans, you know, largely unchanged. I mean, his approval has gone down 8 points. But again, that's from right after his election. It's easy to make too much of that. But among independents, his disapproval has gone up 12 and is sitting at about 60% for the last three polls. His disapproval or his approval has gone down by 8 points since the start. And so we're seeing this just all over the place. And so, I mean, Texas is a little bit less pronounced than it is nationally because of the distribution of the state. We've got more Republicans here than other people. Yeah. The real challenge, I mean, outside of, you know, just sort
and
of—
And a lot of very conservative—
And a lot of very conservative independents.
You know, this gets to the point, conservative / MAGA / what—
Right. We have, we got plenty of everybody, I mean, in some ways.
Yeah.
But yes, we have more of that. We also have conservative-leaning independents here, probably, for the most part.
Yes, which makes that independent number kind of interesting.
Well, and this is where I think, and this is what I think points to the real challenge here, and this is the challenge that the president's team is very aware of, Republicans are very aware of, and it's the economy, right? And it's this issue of, you know, the president had a hard time saying this, but this issue of affordability, right? And when you look at the same national numbers— And we ask about and we look at Trump's approval on the economy. He's at minus 17 on average on the economy. Remember, overall, he was at minus 12.7. So his evaluations of his handling of the economy are worse than evaluations of his job approval overall.
Yeah.
And when we look at our numbers here, we see 52% of Texans, so a majority disapproving of the job that he's doing on the economy. His approval is only 36%. So his disapproval is a little higher. His approval is a little bit lower. And the key here, again,
the economy thing, just one more, you know, the other tab on that is that, you know, among Republicans, he's still fine on the economy in Texas, but about 10 points lower than his overall.
Well, about 10 points lower than his overall at 73% approve overall. But the problem, you know, here even, and I think this is a problem for elections, right? But that approval rating among Republicans, 73% approval in October on the economy.
Right.
Is tracks with where he's been. So first point, lack of erosion is key, right? So in August, he was
at 70. The extent that there's erosion, it's not really among Republicans.
Right. So 73% in October, 75% in August, 74% in June, you know, 76% in April. So he's sitting in the same place on the economy that he's been throughout much of his presidency. The problem is, just for like electoral politics, is if we go back to 2020 data, he was at 91% among Republicans, right? Yeah. There's overwhelming approval of his handling of the economy. And so, I mean, you can say, well, you know, that's not, I don't know, 15 points is kind of a lot. And it's not as though, again, we've talked about this a lot. It's not as though, you know, Republicans are going to
abandon
Trump
wholesale.
And start, you know, voting for, you know, Gavin Newsom acolytes or whatever all over the place. But when you're talking about mobilizing people and he's not on the ballot and his, you know, position is not as strong, even if it remains very strong.
And look, not to make this seem more complicated or insightful. Yeah. I mean, it's a general question right now about whether Trump presidential voters in presidential years turn out in midterm years.
Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of indication that they're less likely to do so.
Well, I think one of the things, you know,
especially in some cohorts.
Right. And I think what, you know, you and I were talking about a little bit before this is like, you know, I think one of the difficulties in the last couple of weeks is that there's been an effort to sort of, we could talk about this. I mean, I'll frame it and then you react. You know, I think there's been something of an effort to maybe overcomplicate or overinterpret some of the actions institutionally where we've seen some pushback from Republicans, right. You know, and sort of this idea that, like, as you point out, the Fishers, the coalition, you know, has he lost MAGA Republicans? Oh, my God. You know, and if you read this stuff, there's just been a ton of this kind of coverage. Okay. Interesting. Sure.
Yeah.
But there's also part of it, which, you know, we're talking about this morning, which is just like, you know, yeah, maybe that's happening. But also, like, he's not running again. He's in his second term. He's not a lame duck yet, but he's approaching that status at a certain point, which I'll let you get to.
Yeah.
And also, his numbers are deteriorating. And so, you know, there's a certain just sort of assertion. I mean, we've kind of been dealing with a lot. You know, how much of this is just normal politics and institutions asserting themselves in regular, you know, in a regular way? And how much of this is, you know, one of these, you know, again, like everything else about Trump. And part of this is a very understandable media-driven, you know, framing. Totally unique, first ever. We've never seen anything like this, right? And I think, you know, part of it is at least in this moment right now, looking at all the data, and it's like, well, this kind of makes sense just in a basic, normal understanding of politics, at least to me. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think that's the question, right? I mean, I think, you know, you said we were talking about on the way in. I mean, it's been a challenge for 10 years now, so we ought to be used to it, right? Which is, you know, to what extent do, you know, the usual structural patterns prevail? To what extent, you know, is Trump's position unique, immune, works differently in conjunction with those normal patterns? And now we just have the extra wrinkle of considering another couple of normal patterns that we haven't seen with him before, which is, you know, presumably he can't run for reelection.
Right.
And, you know, there is a kind of, you know, there's a looming lame duck pattern, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think, you know, as you were saying, I mean, I think we're not quite ready to declare it that. But that's part and parcel of this question about is he losing the support of MAGA or whatever. And I do think that, on one hand, there's not much evidence of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you unpacked this well earlier when we were coming into the office. I mean, you know, the Epstein thing is kind of it's a strange case, right?
Well, yeah.
I mean, if this turns out to be a kind of limit case of Donald Trump's power, what's the next one? I don't know. I mean,
you to jump back in. I mean, but part of this is like to say, like, oh my God, the Congress faced with universal public opinion and both parties all holding the same views about this. Decides to stand up against the only person who seems to have a problem with it, who really is ready to just flip positions anyway once they kind of the cards are laid out. I mean, that's not like an amazing assertion of.
No.
I mean, I'll say at first, you know, I'll be honest, and I don't know the specifics of it, so I don't want to jump into it. I mean, I think if I was looking for something more interesting, I'm more interested in like Indiana not redistricting than I am in this vote. You know, it's like just to say that out loud. I mean, one thing that I think is interesting about this is you know, one of the challenges maybe in analyzing this, and you were kind of pointing this out, is, you know, this idea that, like, oh, he's losing, you know, is he losing his grip over MAGA? And it's like, no, that's not the issue, because I think, you know, to your point about he's not a lame duck, because we still have Republican primaries and his endorsement is still so important. And I wonder how much of the challenge here is a function of the fact that his power among the Republican base and among the, you know, the quote unquote MAGA Republicans is so strong. And the challenge is really the divergence between how strong his hold is on this group in the electorate and where his views are and where his hold is going with everybody else.
Right.
Right. And that's when we talk about things like, you know, I mean, we're talking real quick about the economy, and I was saying we focus on the Republican thing, but the fact is he's way underwater with independents. 61% we're talking about Texas here, disapprove of his handling of the economy, 74% of inflation prices. Among Hispanics, it's 59 and 66%. Among suburban voters in Texas, which is where a lot of the competition is, it's 56 and 59% disapproval. Even in rural parts of the state, which is overwhelmingly Republican on inflation and prices, 44-44.
Yeah.
And so it's like, on the one hand, you know, as your point, you know, this idea of like, well, how, you know, the every other sort of elite Republican politician has to address the fact that, you know, his endorsement or his endorsement for somebody else is a big, big factor in the primaries that are coming up. But after that.
Yeah, no, I mean,
normal politics.
Yeah. And I think the point I was trying to make this morning when we were talking about it is that, you know, so I don't think we can really even begin to make a judgment about the state of Trump's overall position or his hold on the base until we see till after the primaries.
Yeah.
And because the, you know, there's still too many elite incentives, you know, and so, you know, you look at like the things that are driving this discussion recently, the idea that, you know, I mean, you've got, you know, the Epstein thing, which what it is. You know, but there are these kind of other flashes of expressions of autonomy or, you know, people sending up trial balloons. But the people and the issues that this is over are, you know, not going to boil over, I think, until after the Republican primary. I mean, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to do what Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to do. But, you know, I think people are right to focus on what her arguments have been, which is, you know, she's really, you know, she's leaning a lot into the foreign policy and the fact that, you know, Trump just seems to not be delivering on, you know, kind of this, you know, these America first, you know.
Right.
I mean, she's trying to rebrand. I mean, I, you know, saw some hashtag she was promoting, you know, something like, you know, making America great again and America first.
Yeah.
And, you know, silly in some ways, but also, but telling that there is something going on there.
Well, I mean, and I don't want to like, I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking about this now, but
you know, you were saying this is another one of those resumption of the normal pattern, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Not, you know, and this is all over the place. Not our take. It's a widely kind of, you know, that, you know, presidents tend to be more interested in foreign policy and legacy and things like that in a second term.
Right. And I think it's also not surprisingly someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's a very enterprising politician, if you want to describe her any way at all, you can say that. But also, I've been having a lot of talks with people this week about divergences between sort of Ted Cruz's positions and the positions of the president. And I think in both cases, you know, you look at people who, you know, expect their political careers to go on beyond Donald Trump's term and are looking at what the Republican Party is going to be in 2, 3, 4 years from this time. And in the case of someone like Cruz here in Texas, is someone who I would say there's no indication that he ever like stopped being interested in the presidency or doesn't want to be a leader in terms of what it means to be a conservative and, you know, sort of a thought leader in the party. Yeah. And he's been, you know, obviously cowed pretty aggressively over the period. I mean, I'll take that back. He's been cowed in certain ways. He's found other ways to honestly, I mean, really, really smartly expand his brand and his audience.
No,
and his
I think in interesting ways he's been less cowed than a lot of others.
It's true.
He's been more, you know. Some people, I think, I mean, and look, you know, whatever, we can parse this probably to a point of non-productiveness.
Oh, I doubt it.
You know, but, you know, I do think
Cruz
has been an interesting case in terms of when he's decided to align himself with Trump and how he has, I think, all along still been keeping an eye on maintaining his own brand and a certain amount of distinctiveness
for himself. I think that's totally fair. And I also I think it's not, you know, it's not being too deferential to him or anything to note that, like, I think Ted Cruz, you know, believes a lot of what he says in a way that's really, I'm not saying that other people don't, I'm just saying it's a scale and it's a continuum and some people are more flexible on their positions than others. And I think Cruz, at least on a lot of issues, has, you know, demonstrated himself pretty committed to his positions. And so,
I mean, look, he's a, you know, look, he's a, he practices, you know, Weber, he practices politics as a vocation.
Yes.
You know, he is attentive to the, you know, the ethics of responsibility to all those former intern students out there from a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, attentive to the political requirements and pragmatism, but does have some ideological ultimate ends, ethics of ultimate ends slash North Stars that he probably keeps in mind more than a lot of others.
So at the end of the day, you're kind of like, oh, so these politicians who have, you know, career, you know, career goals beyond the next 2 years are thinking about it. It's like, I think they are. You know, does it mean that the coalition is breaking apart at the seams? No, not yet. I mean, certainly.
Right.
And so I think that's like,
but there's a natural look, you know, coalition, you know, coalitions that are built, I mean, I guess is the way I would put this. There's a proposition.
Okay.
Coalitions that are built around presidential candidacies have a natural half-life.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And that's right.
Right. And in the midst of them, we're almost, you know, there's almost always a degree of myopia when we kind of say, you know, the Obama coalition.
Right.
And then it fell apart and then the Democrats were in trouble.
Yeah.
The MAGA coalition. And then it fell apart and then the Republicans got it. You know, we can go back.
Yeah.
You know, big, you know, presidential candidate driven party coalitions. Mm-hmm. You know, and in presidential elections are always partially driven by that. And it's a big time to have Darren around. But, you know, I mean, all things being equal, there is a natural half-life that is kind of structural.
Yeah.
You know, and I would, you know, this goes to, this kind of brings us back and connects with the Trump singularity problem.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, you know, one could argue that, you know, Trump, you know, is an interesting case in which he does seem to have kept key parts of the coalition together, reconstituted it again under very favorable circumstances,
yeah.
you know, between 2016 and 2023,
right.
2024. But even then, the coalition shifted.
Yeah.
You know, with some local factors, you know, I mean, the whole, you know,
right.
question of Latinos and all that. But that's another...
But that's another big part of it.
But that's another big part of what's going on right now is that his Latino job approval numbers or his favorability numbers among Latino in our poll.
Yeah.
And we're seeing similar things in national polling. There was some of this in the Marist poll, in the Marist NPR poll, I think, that I saw mm-hmm. sort of highlighted by somebody. You know, that you know, that's not really very operative right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the floor has probably moved up, and that I think, you know.
Yeah, we talked
yeah,
about this.
Yeah, the floor
last
has moved up, but I mean, at this point, it's not like, you know, but this, there's also kind of a clear ceiling, and it's getting a little bit.
And for those
lower.
In Texas, I mean, the floor's not moved up very much.
No, I mean, it's
I
really
don't
almost
think,
a re-
at least not in the favorability numbers as we see them.
No, it looks like a reassertion of where we were in some ways, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, but the difference is that Hispanics are a bigger part of the electorate.
Yeah, we probably need to go and kind of unpack like some of just the self, you know, self-identified party ID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and see what it looks like now.
Yeah, and you just kind of look at what that looks like in the data we have. So I guess where do we end up with this? I mean, you know, there's something going on. I think it's still premature to kind of say, you know, it's cracking up.
You know? Yeah. Well, you know, I'll say this. You know, we were talking again on the way in, and I think in the wake of the 2020 election, you know, in the face of sort of a lot of really, you know, a lot of disbelief in some cases among Republicans that Trump lost. And whatever that was based on, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to set that aside.
Although we know what it was based on.
Yeah. Well, we know what a lot of it was based on. But, you know, in facing that, you know, part of what I kind of came away with is sort of point out, like, look, you know, he was underwater on job approval. The economy was a real problem. People were very concerned about it. We're in the middle of a pandemic that people were very concerned about that they felt like he wasn't taking seriously.
Right.
And whether his name is Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, you know, anybody, that's a tough election to run in. It'd be very yeah. hard to win that election. And that's just basic politics because of just the fundamental things that we know about what mattered. And part of it is like, you know, as singular as Trump may be on a lot of things, and I think it's very fair to point that out, and as unprecedented as a lot of things may be, these factors still exist.
Yeah.
And they're still out there. And part of it is if you're looking around like, okay, so we've got a president in his second term focusing more on foreign policy and legacy building. We've got, you know, some signs of some pushback, you know, even if minimal within his coalition as we kind of get more towards the midterms, especially with, you know, shaky economy and, you know, some tough numbers. You know, again, it's one thing to say, do you want Trump's endorsement? Do you want him to come campaign with you for the general? That's the thing that yeah. we're kind of looking ahead to. And, and all that is, you know, again, whether it was Donald Trump, whether it's Joe Biden with someone else, these are all kind of normal things. And in some ways, there's almost a reassertion of just some normal politics here in some sense, even if the first half of this year felt a little crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the, you know, I hate to resort to the cliche, but I'm going to have to do it anyway, just because we don't have much time left for Ooh. Me to sit here and think about something more.
A better
creative.
Cliche.
Well, it's just, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that Donald Trump has benefited from, but is also the nature, you know, I talked about myopia earlier. Mm. The nature of being absorbed in the day-to-day of politics, mm-hmm. very, very easy to miss the forest for the trees, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there is something of that going on right mm-hmm. now in which,
yeah.
you know, look, on one hand, yeah, there's obviously some things going on. Now, the why that's going on, mm-hmm. the extent of it, is going to be subject to a very familiar dynamic, which is that there's a primary environment and there's a general election environment.
Yep. Yeah. And one's coming up. Next.
Yeah, very close. And, you know, just, you know, fraught with uncertainty.
Yeah.
Because of the closeness of the, you know, the partisan division in Congress and all this redistricting stuff going on.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. you know, I think with that, I think we ought to leave it at that.
Yeah, let's leave it at
that.
We'll
leave it with the forest and the trees.
I think we solved that one. You're welcome, everybody.
Check. That's very, you know, just a random observation. For some reason, I've just wanted to mention this. So I watched the part of the, just because it came on after the news, the PBS American Revolution documentary.
Oh, I've heard mixed reviews, but I'm interested. Because I mean, I've been, you know, I've been reading a lot about.
Yeah, no, I know. That's why I was thinking that, you know, and it's kind of, it's for me, it's like, you know, I don't know much about like them. I just watched like episode 3 or something to start with 4 or whatever they broadcast last night. And it was a lot of the mid-level military maneuvering after Revolutionary War started. And I just don't know much of that military history.
Yeah, I do.
You know, and it was interesting to just, you know, watch all that, but also to revisit all that. And thinking about the politics, I'm not even sure it really connects to any of this other than that, hey, it's out there, and it was kind of interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think the Wall Street Journal had some, the Wall Street Journal editorial page had a thing about how it was, they didn't use the word, but it obviously connects to another thing going on in Texas right now that I don't want to give oxygen to. But, you know, kind of a, they didn't use it kind of woke or, they used a more Wall Street Journal editorial page.
Yeah, well.
You know, a characterization of the narrative. But it, you know, pretty interesting to look at the, you know, the politics, you know, went back and watched a little of the first one. And
it's, I mean,
you know,
again, I haven't watched that. I mean, I've read a lot recently about it. And it is, if you go back into that history, and I think, you know, our colleague Darren is really good about, you know, sort of reminding people that, you know, it's really easy to sort of have this view of the past as like, you know, like there was this, well, back then everybody had a sense of purpose, right? And it's like, no, not at all. And it was like, you know, it's basically you have this army kind of running away most of the time and mostly lucky that basically the British kind of were not that interested.
It was interesting to watch the middle episode and then go back and watch the beginning so you can see where the foreshadowing they're going to go. I mean, they talk about, you know, Washington discovering very early in his career that, you know, sometimes it was, you know, you needed to just know when to retreat.
Oh, yeah, he learned that the hard way.
Yeah, well, but he even learned it, you know, but the easy thing, you know, how he learned it even as like a junior officer, right, in the French Indian War.
Yeah, in the French and Indian War. Yeah,
so anyway, kind of an interesting thing. And to your point about the messiness of it all.
Oh, so messy.
You know, you forget the fight between the Loyalists and the Patriots was, you know, pretty rough. You know, a lot of people beating the crap out of each other in the street.
And that's the best thing that happened. And not only that, but I mean, there's fights. I mean, look, for the most part, you know, if you were one of the states, you were not trying to send your militia to help this quote unquote national army. You're trying to protect your own stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was fighting going on.
I don't give a shit about those guys in Pennsylvania.
No, I mean, there was so much fighting going on internally. While, you know, this sort of malaria, you know, this sort of plagued army was just sort of bloodily marching along, trying to avoid the British. And really, just by the skin of their teeth, were lucky that the British commanders were, like, slightly less interested.
Yeah, and made some real strategic errors.
Yeah.
You know, so. Anyway, check it out.
Yeah, I'm down.
With that, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Liberal Arts Development Studio at UT Austin, as always. Thanks to Josh for being here. You know, we didn't talk about a ton of data here, but as always, data, lots of other treats, downloadable graphics for your, you know, teaching. If you're teaching, it's getting to the end of the semester, download some graphics, drop them in your slides. Very easy.
Maybe you're going to see family over the holidays and you'd like to spur a discussion.
Yeah. You know, you could give people, you could give people a gift, make them some calendars using Texas Politics Project graphics.
Cool.
So anyway, all the results we've talked about and other interesting things at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. I believe we will be taking next week off for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I think so.
But then we'll be back after that with another second reading podcast. So have a good holiday. If you're traveling, travel safe. If you're in Central Texas, look out for the rain. As always, I can't tell exactly how bad. I think it's going to be worse in some places than others. But
that's really,
you know,
brilliant analysis.
Turn around, turn around, don't drown. How's that?
There we go.
So thanks for listening. Signing out, finally. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.